Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Today on the show, first responders from across the state gathered for a mental health conference.
You just see just horrendous child sexual assault. You have to look at it, you have to watch it, you have to listen to it. And that, if that doesn't affect you, there's probably something wrong with you.
Doctors, nurses, pharmacists, lab techs, almost all those professions get their first taste of science at college. A University of Wyoming professor speaks about what federal cuts could do to his program.
If I didn't have funds for research, I can't do that for students anymore.
And we hear an artist translate a new mural at the Center of the West in Cody into sound. Those stories and more, stay with us. This is Open Spaces. If you're in the Sheridan area, we're inviting you to grab a mug of coffee with Wyoming Public Media reporters. Share feedback, give us a news tip, or just get to know us. Plus, you'll have the chance to get an exclusive Wyoming Public Radio news mug. You can't get it anywhere else. Join us from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Monday, August 11th at Java Moon Coffee.
The Wyoming Public Radio app delivers great music 24/7. Stream Wyoming Sounds, Jazz Wyoming, and Classical Wyoming. Download the Wyoming Public Radio app at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Firefighters, police officers, EMS techs, 911 dispatchers. Those are just a few of the first responders who met up recently in Casper for a conference on mental health. It's a serious subject. First responders are more likely to experience mental health conditions than the general public. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements reports, stigmas often keep emergency workers from talking about the toll their jobs can take.
The Best Western Hotel is the place. Cowboy Country is the music. And the mental well-being of Wyoming's first responders is the theme. People like Chris McDonald say this conversation would have been unthinkable when he started working in law enforcement 25 years ago.
It would never come up. You suck it up. Yeah, you're going to see bad stuff all the time. Suck it up. We don't want to hear about it.
Now, McDonald, a senior investigator for the state fire marshal, is among fire chiefs, street cops, their spouses, and guest speakers, all mixing it up in the hotel ballroom. Almost a third of first responders experience behavioral health conditions like depression and PTSD due to the stress of their jobs. That's significantly higher than the general public, according to one study. Folks at the conference said it rings true.
You know, you see all these terrible things during the day, and you roll up in your driveway, at the end of shift, and you're home to your family just like anybody else in the community.
You never know what's coming on the other end of that phone call, and so you always are prepared for the worst case scenario. And so when that phone rings, then you start getting that anxiety, that anxiousness of...
You just see just horrendous child sexual assault. You have to look at it, you have to watch it, you have to listen to it. And that, if that doesn't affect you, there's probably something wrong with you.
That's Chris McDonald again. Before investigating fires, McDonald used to lead Wyoming's Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. He started a partnership between his unit and a mental health clinician, something he took advantage of himself. Those personal experiences, paired with watching how last year's historic fire season weighed down crews across the state, led him to help organize this conference.
First number I got, 840-4897. Anybody?
In between Woo-hoo! Speakers hey, sharing how they came back from their worst moments, conference leaders raffle off boxes of Michelob Ultra and coffee mugs. Therapy dogs abound. Zach Gonzalez is a Casper police officer who goes by Gonzo. He helped organize the conference with the Wyoming Peace Officers Association. Before he was a cop, he went through his own share of mental health struggles after a gym he started closed down during the pandemic.
Kind of like a midlife crisis, if you will. Lost my whole purpose. I mean, it's what I dedicated my entire life to. And for about a year and a half, I was in a struggle bus, dude. Totally lost, like just absolutely in a dark hole.
Gonzalez's mental health conference is only possible because of a grant from the State Department of Health.
Here in Wyoming, Montana, South, more of these rural areas, we do have resources. It's just not marketed like it is on the East Coast and the West Coast. Our hope with this, like I said, is this being the first one, we would attract people from surrounding states to help create more of an awareness.
Jack Fetter is a patrol sergeant for the Casper Police and a peer support coordinator for his coworkers. He's noticed a disconnect between the dynamic day-in and day-out work he and others are doing versus the way people in the community view his job.
We respond to houses for calls for service, and we'll go inside this house, and they'll have cops on TV. We'll be standing there, and they're actually watching cops or live PD on TV. It's happened.
What custody?
I don't know what necessarily goes through my head, but I just find it fascinating.
Fetter also sees more that could be done to fight mental health issues, particularly by the state of Wyoming.
I think Wyoming, we're sort of a little bit behind the times, and it takes us a while to catch up. I think more resources can be put towards it.
Shana Smith came to the conference from the other end of the spectrum. She's a psychologist in Cheyenne who specializes in police psychology. Smith says working with first responders on their mental health requires a certain kind of cultural competency.
They can see through your bullshit really easily, right? That they're trained to read people, and so you really just gotta be genuine. You gotta have a good bullshit meter.
Smith explains the way U.S. society is set up contributes to feelings of isolation in first responders.
When you traumatize a few people, and then they expect to carry that trauma alone, then we end up with a traumatized few and a naive rest of society, this very us versus them culture.
But that dynamic could be so much better, she says.
We, as civilians, have to be able to ask, in a not weird way, our first responder brothers and sisters, like, hey, like, how are you, actually? What is this job like? And be willing to hear that without judgment, which is rare in society now. And it's simple. It's talking, it's community, it's caring, it's love, it's compassion.
In the meantime, there is one thing Chris McDonald says could go a long way in improving emergency workers' mental health.
More dogs. More comfort dogs.
Based on his sniffing, the therapy dog Axel Rose concurs.
Just a couple of steps.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements in Casper.
It's been 15 years since Wyoming saw a case of measles. Before that, another 10 years. The highly infectious, sometimes fatal disease was considered eradicated in the state in 2000. But in the past several weeks, measles has been found in 3 Wyoming counties. The state health department thinks it might be spreading in one. Nationwide this year, measles has killed 3 people, and 13% of people who've caught it ended up in the hospital. Wyoming Public Radio's Nikki Woulette spoke with the state epidemiologist, Clay Van Houten, about where measles has been found in the state, how our herd immunity is doing, and how you can protect yourself and your family.
Wyoming has identified 7 cases of measles. Mm-hmm. Can you just share what's known about these cases?
So our first case was identified in Natrona County. We did not find the source or the likely source of infection for that child, which was a little bit concerning. We then had a second case in Niobrara County. Again, really couldn't find the source of infection for that child either. You know, I was a little bit worried that we might see more cases in those areas just because we couldn't identify the source. But I think we're far enough out now that we likely aren't going to see any more in those areas, at least related to those 2 cases. Now, in Carbon County, we have 5 cases. The first case there, we pretty quickly ascertained that that person was exposed outside of the country. And so since that first case, the additional 4 have all had some link to a known case.
Is there any indication from these cases that measles is spreading in Wyoming?
Yeah, I think in Carbon County, for sure. I would expect us to see more cases reported from Carbon County and identified there.
I mean, measles can be a very, very serious infection without breaking HIPAA or invading people's privacy. What can you share about how they're doing?
Yeah. So the cases have recovered, or more recent cases, they're still sick. We've been really, I think, blessed that none of the cases have been hospitalized thus far, which you can see quite a high percentage of measles cases that require hospitalization as a consequence of the infection. But so far, everybody's doing well and no hospitalizations, which is great.
Yeah, yeah. And the folks who are catching it, have they been vaccinated against the illness?
Our most recent case in Carbon County was previously vaccinated. Unfortunately, that individual had some underlying health conditions that created an immunocompromised situation where they were much more susceptible to infection. So they had been vaccinated, but immunocompromised and unfortunately developed illness.
Mm-hmm.
The others were all unvaccinated.
So how does the health department find these cases? Like, are people coming into like the hospital or a clinic situation?
Yeah, that's exactly what's been occurring. And measles can be really tough to diagnose at first. So the first set of symptoms that someone can get, and it's generally a pretty high fever, runny nose, cough, some red eyes. So of course, those symptoms can look like a lot of different things. And then a few days later, the patients will develop a rash. So the rash starts at the hairline, starts moving down the body out to the limbs. And that's really when it becomes pretty indicative of measles.
And if someone is experiencing some kind of symptoms and they're concerned, what's the best next steps for them?
Please call ahead to your healthcare provider before you go in to see them. We've seen this now with multiple cases of ours. It's of no fault of anybody's. Those first symptoms look like a lot of different diseases. So if you're suspecting measles at all, call ahead, just because it is so contagious. They can do some things within those clinics to, isolate you in a room, keep you away from other susceptible people in the clinics or ER.
I'm thinking about folks in Carbon County and what actions can people take to protect themselves and their families against measles?
Yeah, the first and biggest is to, speak with our healthcare providers about getting vaccinated. If they're not already vaccinated, or if they are unsure whether they were vaccinated in the past, we recommend anybody that has questions about that, that they contact their healthcare provider and work through those questions and make sure that, they need the vaccination, it's right for them. It's a very high protection rate. Two doses usually protects about 97% of people. So it's a pretty good vaccine, and it does confer lifelong immunity. Certainly when we're talking to the cases, we work really hard with them to make sure they're not out and about while they're infectious. That also helps protect people as well. And then having enough people vaccinated that can protect everyone.
How many folks in Wyoming have had this vaccine, and is something like herd immunity going to help us against measles?
Yeah, certainly herd immunity does help. And a kind of consensus on the percentage of the population that you need vaccinated to protect against measles, to develop, this herd immunity, is about 93%.
Oh, wow, that's high.
Yeah, it is high. But fortunately, that's about right where we are at currently in Wyoming. We're just a little bit above 93%.
Are you noticing a drop-off rate in people getting MMR vaccine?
Yeah, I think overall the vaccine rates have dipped a little bit. The last 2 years of Wyoming data looks like we've remained pretty steady, which is good. We're still doing really well with our vaccination rates with some of these kind of key childhood diseases that we want to protect against.
I hate to go here, but I'm curious what are you worried about? What's like the worst case scenario in your mind?
Oh gosh, I think certainly worst case scenario is we have someone who's severely ill and, requires prolonged hospitalization, or heaven forbid we have a death related to this. That's my worst fear with this disease. It's pretty serious, and it's so contagious. spreads very easily, can remain in the air for a couple of hours after the person leaves a room.
Yeah. What about for like healthcare systems though? Are we like facing a situation where we could see local clinics, hospitals inundated and not able to meet everyone who needs care?
No, I don't think we're in a situation like that. Certainly not like we were with COVID and even sometimes get with seasonal flu. And I think, you know, part of that is we're pretty well vaccinated in Wyoming. So we've got a small number of people who are still susceptible. And even though it's circulating among those people, I don't think it's enough to certainly inundate a clinic or a hospital.
Okay, there's a silver lining. We'll take it.
Yeah, exactly.
Clay Van Houten, epidemiologist for the state of Wyoming, thank you so, so much for sharing this information with us.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It's nice talking to you.
Staying with health. Proposed cuts to health research funding could stifle education and job opportunities in Wyoming. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
It can be hard to keep track of the news, but Wyoming Public Radio just made it a little easier. Now you can follow us on Apple News to get the latest stories from Wyoming right in the palm of your hand. Plus, you can get an audio roundup of daily local news in under 10 minutes with our new podcast. Check out Wyoming Debrief, a morning habit that pairs perfectly with your cup of coffee.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Health researchers are worried. Back in March, as the Trump administration proposed sweeping cuts to staffing and funding for medical research, top professors started sounding the alarm.
This is going to affect health and the life expectancy of Americans.
That's Dr. Stephen Wolf speaking to PBS NewsHour. He's a professor at the Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine.
The net effect of this is we're slower in identifying new treatments for cancer, new ways of treating heart disease, and we're going to lose our edge, and the implications are ultimately going to affect everyday Americans.
Some researchers at the University of Wyoming say these downsizes will also hurt their students' growth and job prospects. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan spoke to one professor about how budget cuts could affect his lab, his students, and our pursuit to improve health outcomes more broadly.
David Fay is a professor at the University of Wyoming, where he runs a nationally recognized molecular biology research program.
I kind of run a small business within the state of Wyoming. I employ maybe a half a dozen full-time people. I love being at the University of Wyoming because it's not an Ivy League school. It's affordable. It's for everyone. And so training students from Wyoming is one of the most gratifying things I can imagine doing.
They research everything from genes and cancer to worm molting, specifically roundworms shedding their skin. About a third of the world's people are infected with the parasites that can cause icky health issues and even collapse agricultural systems. So Faye's research will ideally help develop drugs that can get rid of them by only targeting the molting process and not killing other things in our bodies. But to do all this potentially life-saving work, Faye needs money. The main source of funding for his lab is federal from the National Institutes of Health, which the Trump administration is proposing a 40% budget cut to.
If I don't have that money, I'm shutting my lab down. There's nothing else I can do.
There's also proposals to cut general university research funding, what Faye calls indirects.
These turn out to be absolutely essential for the research to be carried out. We're talking about basic utilities, building maintenance, core infrastructure, accounting, purchasing, grants management, hiring, biological safety, compliance, you know, you name it, there is a cost associated with it.
Trump wants to cap indirects at 15%. Faye says UW's are currently almost 45%.
Our costs are really at the low end, and if you cut into that much, then places like UW won't be able to afford to carry out scientific research on their campuses. And that's probably true for nearly every university in the country.
For Faye, that means scores of students losing out on being a part of his science lab, which means more textbook time and less learning by doing.
We'll have to talk about research that other people have done, not things we're doing. And for a lot of students, getting into the lab and getting their hands dirty, it's a benefit to them personally, but it also looks great on their resumes.
And while getting their hands dirty in the lab may not necessarily lead to groundbreaking cures, Faye argues they're helping solve one corner of the jigsaw puzzle of health science. Take his skin-shedding worms. Many who went to see the federal cuts say it's up to the private sector to take on this kind of niche research. But Faye says companies can't afford the bold funding risks it takes to discover new ideas.
And so you really need academia to sort of plant those seeds. And they get to a certain point where, yeah, those companies can then take on a certain amount of risk to bring those forward to the next step. They're not going to make those really early investments. They just can't afford to do that.
And Faye says those seemingly off-the-wall ideas lead to things that have impacted just about everyone.
Every cancer treatment, every vaccine, there's essentially no treatments that have probably not had their roots somewhere in university research.
Faye says America taking its foot off the research pedal means other countries will pull ahead and even pull workers and knowledge out of the U.S. and Wyoming. Now, a lot of this is still up in the air. There's been some U.S. congressional members sounding similar alarms, and most recently, a Senate committee pushed back on Trump's proposed cuts, going so far as to suggest a modest increase. When Congress reconvenes this fall, the funding outlook is expected to become more clear. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan.
We should add, President Trump signed a new executive order Thursday that focuses on federal grants, including for research. Grants will now require approval from the head of the awarding federal agency. Some are concerned about political appointees having final say in independent research. The executive order says awarded grants must be, quote, consistent with agency priorities and the national interest, unquote. Nebraska, Colorado, and Wyoming are known to have the most hailstorms in the country. That's according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The area where these three states meet is known as Hail Alley. On average, it sees 7 to 9 hail days per year. And hailstorms are the most costly weather disaster. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Rachel Cohen reports, hail causes tens of billions of dollars in damage each year to cars, crops, and roofs. But much about it remains a mystery.
Dewey Kahawai was sleeping when he heard a knock on his bedroom window.
I sprang out of bed and thought, oh my gosh, somebody's trying to get into my house.
Then he heard thumps on the roof, and he knew a hailstorm was sweeping through his town Milliken, 50 miles north of Denver. Neighbors saw ice chunks almost the size of baseballs. Kahawai's house was fine, but by morning, his phone was blowing up with calls and texts. He runs his own company, American Pride Auto Glass.
That's the window that I replaced today.
For 2 weeks, he worked 14-plus hour days crisscrossing town.
People's cars that were literally destroyed. 3 or 4 inch diameter holes through the glass on their vehicles. Front windshields with 6, 8 hits.
Kahawai estimates he alone attended to hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of damage in this late June storm. Ian Giamenko says hail costs can add up. He's a researcher at the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety.
It's not as big a life safety threat as, say, a storm surge or flash flooding or a tornado, but it happens every single year, and it's costing us just tens of billions of dollars.
And the costs are increasing, partly because more people are moving to places with hailstorms, and researchers think climate change could mean fewer but more destructive storms.
If you look at this growing loss picture, this is something that is not sustainable at this rate.
In Colorado, for instance, hail is a big reason why insurance premiums are going up. Becky Adams Seelin says this is a problem because there's still a lot we don't know about hail, and she's a scientist who studies it.
How fast does a hailstone fall? How does it melt? Like, again, all things that seem pretty basic but are surprisingly difficult to try to unpack.
For example, Adam Seelin says a lot of our models assume hail is a perfect sphere. It's not. So to find more answers, she's leading a huge team of researchers, including Giamenko, on the largest study of hail in 40 years. It's called IceChip. For 6 weeks this summer, scientists chased hailstorms around the Great Plains and Mountain West, where hail is most common, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico.
There were some fantastic storms.
They laid out a bunch of measuring devices on the ground and flew drones into the clouds. After storms passed, researchers jumped out of their cars and rushed to scoop hailstones into freezers.
Almost a softball size. A few more nice big ones, some really nice lobes on this one.
Some of the ice balls, 26 boxes worth, are now stacked in a special cold lab at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado.
Are you ready?
Anthony Bernal Ayala is a postdoc clad in a full-body puffy suit. Over the next few months, he'll be in this closet-sized freezer recording all sorts of details about the hailstones, their size, weight. He'll even cut some open.
Hailstone is kind of like its own lab. It's a chronicle of time that will save its information within its crystalline structure.
He says the big insights will come from matching each hailstone up with the storm data. That'll uncover why certain ingredients in the sky, like temperature, humidity, wind, make a different recipe of hail that falls to the ground. The results could help us better prepare.
Hazard,
quarter-size hail. Adam Seelan hopes it could be used to give more detailed warnings and share information like...
The hail swath's going to be about 5 miles wide, and it'll probably produce hail for an hour. And it's going to be blown by winds at 20 miles an hour. Like, that would be awesome!
She says that could signal when to pull a car into a garage, drape netting over crops, or find shelter. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Rachel Cohen.
Up next, we ask an artist to translate his visual mural into sound. Stay with us on Open Spaces.
Want to do more than just listen to Wyoming Public Radio? You can help us through our new volunteer platform. We're looking for a few folks to pick up court documents, take photos, and promote local events. Sign up with the volunteer button at the top of our website. We depend on you as much as you rely on us.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kodalska. Often we hear the story of human impacts on buffalo, but a new mural at the Plains Indian Museum in Cody centers the national mammal and explores how they interact with other species and the environment. It's a work that also teaches us respect for the power of wild animals, the artist says. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats got a sneak peek as the mural was going up.
The mural takes up an entire wall in the museum. John Hitchcock's team is hammering paper cutouts of red-tailed hawks into the sky section of the mural. This part is painted royal blue to indicate nighttime. The birds of prey soar through constellations. They're screen printed, giving them varying shades of pink and red. In the lower part of the mural that's painted pale blue, pink buffalo march through black trees and green ducks. A black and white buffalo skull sits in the center. Dragonflies, butterflies, and birds emanate out of it. Hitchcock is one of the mural's creators.
I'm an enrolled member of the Kiowa tribe of Oklahoma, and I'm Comanche as well as Northern European.
He's also a musician.
Speed metal to country and western to folk and now Americana folk music.
Sound is often part of his art installations. With that in mind, I asked him to compose a song to express the mural sonically.
I'm letting the work speak to me and thinking about tones and sound and how they can reference back to shape. And one of the things about printmaking in particular, which I teach, is it's all about layers, and music is the same thing. So I think about if you have one component you put up or an object such as this large buffalo here, and then we have Emily Arthur's deer that's up at the top part. The water birds that are referencing the Kiowa Comanche culture that I come from. The horned toad, also the frogs too. Then they're speaking to each other. And so once they start to speak to each other and have this conversation, then you have another buffalo pop up and another one. And so it becomes a chorus. So there's a chorus happening and the layers are starting to happen. And then if you think about a blue bird, water bird that's flying through, that's giving another sound to it. Then you have multiples and you have 20 black dragonflies flying through, then those become a symphony of notes. And so all of these objects that are placed on the wall become a complete composition.
And I think it's really interesting, and I don't know if John meant that, but at one point over this week, he's like, I feel like a conductor.
That's curator Hunter Old Elk, who commissioned this mural for the Plains Indian Museum.
I feel like I'm conducting a symphony of birds and a symphony of art. And he said that just in passing, and it may have been a really intimate moment for him, but that was really impactful for myself to understand the vision. And so with us, it was really important to center the story of buffalo, to really tell that story in reference to its impact to other species. I mean, like here in Cody, Wyoming, and in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, like we were at the epicenter of its loss, right? Like in this region, you saw buffalo dwindle down to the hundreds, and then to see that conservation impact. But people rarely talk about the significance of when the buffalo was lost, what it did to the habitat, right? And so I think what's really interesting is when we're telling that story and we can highlight the story of conservation, we can also see it in the art that was created. When John and I were talking about color and composition, he wanted to do sort of unexpected colors, right? Like a lot of times you see buffalo and they're true to their color. They're brown and they're like, they're dark colors. But here you're seeing like pink buffalo, right? And like that's
future buffalo.
Future buffalo.
They're resilient and their strength and their power, and they will continue to move forward.
You know, I just want the message to come across that it's our social responsibility, it's our responsibility to recognize that when they're healthy, our environments are healthy. When their environments are threatened, all environments are threatened. And that is the story that is ultimately uplifting. And I think when we're talking in terms of generations, that is a generational responsibility. It's not just ours.
The Buffalo Deer Bird Mural is on display at the Plains Indian Museum in Cody. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Olivia Weitz at the Center of the West in Cody.
For millennia, Indigenous peoples have intentionally set fires to care for the land. Colonization and policy largely put an end to those practices, though the tradition endured. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Murphy Woodhouse reports, a new law in California has opened the door to restoring cultural burning, and it could be a potential model for the rest of the West.
On a late June afternoon in the remote northern California town of Orleans, Michael Sanchez hops into a wildland fire truck. He's the prescribed fire and fuel specialist for the Kaiduk tribe and helps organize their cultural burns, including those in his neighborhood that day.
And yeah, one of the burns is my house, so I've been kind of taking the main lead on preparing that.
You got some interest in that burn?
I do, yeah.
While small, they represent a major step forward in the tribe's long-standing effort to promote cultural burning. It's the fruit of years of advocacy and collaboration with federal agencies and nonprofits to bring down barriers to putting good fire on the ground. In 2022, the state established a claims fund for when fires set by landowners and tribes cause damage, reducing financial risk for burners and the public. Then last fall, Senate Bill 310 was unanimously approved. It allows tribes to enter into agreements with the state and bypass regulatory requirements to burn. Kaiduk leaders called it a chance to atone for efforts to stamp out burning well into the 20th century. Sanchez says 310 has made burning much simpler. We pass an orange sign notifying drivers of the cultural burn.
That's one of the requirements. And then also a 72-hour notification to local agencies, Forest Service.
There are a few other steps, like written permission from landowners, but that's about it.
Yep, so yeah, this is my place here.
The first burn of the day is in an adjoining yard. Using lighters, a Karuk trio sets the dry grass and leaves ablaze, checking it with a simple hose. Bill Tripp, the tribe's natural resources director, says the fires help protect homes.
Well, today we're just trying to get rid of this stuff that's going to catch an ember and start a spot fire in the summer.
Bill was taught to burn as a young boy by his great-grandmother, bearer of a time immemorial tradition of using fire for ceremonies and the care of key animal and plant species, like hazel used for basketry. Tripp is the only tribal council-recognized practitioner able to oversee burns, but his people created a process to train more. He and others see these small projects as a way to rebuild skills and a sense of setting fires as common practice.
I would like to see 10 houses just get together, have a barbecue, and get it all burnt in a 2-3 day window.
In 2023, a major federal commission said that beneficial fire, which includes cultural and prescribed burning, is essential to restoring ecosystem health and reducing wildfire risk.
We don't need to reinvent the wheel here.
Dylan Cruz is the president of Sustainable Northwest. Inspired by reforms in California, the nonprofit helped push for a claims fund in Washington and Oregon. While rare, intentional burns can escape control and cause significant harm.
We want to do more cultural burning, but the biggest limiting factor or concern is around liability issues.
He encourages other Western states to work with tribal nations to remove barriers to cultural burning. In a grass field on the outskirts of Orleans, a small team is burning a strip of black around the edge.
Once we get a black line around it, then we can let it rip.
That's Bill's brother, Jacob Tripp. Trailing behind the slow-marching flames, a group of teenagers, seasonal workers for the Natural Resources Department, sprays the edges with bladder bags. Think water guns attached to water-filled backpacks. It's Karuk Youth Council Secretary Chloe King's first burn.
Like, there's a lot of adrenaline going through me right now, but I definitely feel like I'm doing the, like, best thing for the land right now.
Black line complete, the burner's light strips through the interior. Unsatisfied with the speed of progress, Jacob pulls out a propane torch. When he gets back to the first turn of the black line, the flames intensify and then tear through the remaining dry grass. Boxed in by black, the flames quickly diminish.
This is awesome. That was crazy.
Chloe has caught the fire bug. Here's Bill.
A really important part of our Karuk educational process is to make sure that we're putting fire in the hands of our children at a young age and teaching them how to be responsible with it.
Just like his great-grandmother did with him. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Murphy Woodhouse.
This time of the year, it can get hot. That sends a lot of people into rivers, lakes, or reservoirs in search of some cool relief. In Wyoming, agencies will restrict fishing so aquatic life can get even more relief. But as KUNC's Alex Hager reports from northern Colorado, when temps get too high, Steamboat Springs closes a stretch of the Yampa River, not only to fishing, but also to recreating. That sends swimmers, tubers, and anglers scrambling.
It's a postcard perfect summer day in Steamboat. The temperatures are in the low 80s, the sun is shining, and the clear waters of the Yampa River are tumbling through a park.
It's totally amazing. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's free.
Alohi Madrigal is sitting on the rocks with two other mom friends, watching their kids splash around in the river.
For me, that energetic vibe, whether you're, you know, floating on a tube, playing with your friends, that energy just feels really great.
This river is the lifeblood of Steamboat Springs. Its water flows through farm sprinklers and kitchen faucets, but this time of year, it's a mecca for people looking to float and fish. So it was a big deal when the Yampa shut down for 4 days in July. Just ask the dripping wet kids who came to watch their moms give an interview.
How do you guys feel when they close the river and you can't come?
Sad!
It's the worst thing ever!
Okay, take those tubes.
The river got back open again, but reopenings often don't last the whole summer. And the river has seen closures 7 out of the past 8 years. You see, the shutdowns are designed to protect fish. They get triggered for 3 reasons. The water is too hot, too low, or lacking oxygen. Emily Burke with the nonprofit Friends of the Yampa says all of those things take a toll on fish.
And so, you know, if you have a bunch of people like splashing around in these deep pools where these fish are using as refuge, it's really stressful for them and it can sometimes lead to fish die-offs.
But protecting the river's fish means taking it away from people, those who use it to play and cool off, and the ones who make money renting out tubes and fishing gear. Jenny Carey is the city's open space and trail supervisor.
We hate having to do this because you inevitably will hear from somebody that it's just ruining their day, their business, right? And that's tough. That's a tough spot to be in. We don't want to do that.
Carey says it can be hard to explain river closures to out-of-town tourists, but locals and local businesses are mostly on board, especially because this closure system has been in place for more than 20 years. Johnny Spillane runs a fly fishing shop right on the banks of the Yampa.
July days are our most important days as a business. So losing July days certainly hurts a little bit more, but at the same time, you know, losing the fish in the river would hurt a lot more than that.
Spillane says respecting the closures and keeping the Yampa healthy is good for business in the long term.
For us, you know, protecting the fish, protecting the resources, far much more important than, you know, getting an extra couple days of fishing on the town stretch or, you know, selling a couple dozen extra flies.
Mike Welch agrees. He's the owner of Backdoor Sports. They can rent up to 400 tubes a day during peak season. At $25 a rental, that's big business. Welch says it can be tough dealing with the ebb and flow of closures, but it's easier to prepare because Steamboat officials spell out the reasons the river is closing or opening back up.
The city's done a great job in setting those parameters, right? So we know what the water's looking like and where those closures and when those closures are potentially coming, so we can plan for it.
The city also has to communicate directly to tubers, swimmers, and anglers themselves. They set up signs and try to get the word out about closures. That strategy seems to be working. Back on the rocks next to the Yampa, Alohi Madrigal says when the river is closed, she can just take her kids swimming somewhere else.
If that means that to preserve it, we have to shut it down, then I think it's okay so that we can utilize all the other activities, too.
But on this day, with the sun beating down, the Yampa is still the coolest place to be. In Steamboat Springs, I'm Alex Hager, KUNC.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of Water in the West, produced by KUNC and supported by the Walton Family Foundation. Up next, we get a preview of a couple of summer events in the state. This is Open Spaces.
If you're in the Jackson area, join Wyoming Public Media and KHOL reporters for some coffee and conversation. Share feedback, give us a news tip, or just get to know us. Plus, you'll have the chance to get an exclusive Wyoming Public Radio news mug. You can't get it anywhere else. Join us from 8 to 11 a.m. on Wednesday, August 20th at Healthy Being.
Wyoming Public Radio brings the news to you in our daily and weekly email newsletters. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Summer is full of fun events throughout the state. Cheyenne Frontier Days, Longmire Days, Music Outdoors, and more. We're taking the last part of this week's show to hear from our partners about two happenings coming up. What do Van Gogh's The Starry Night painting, a baseball game, and orchestras all have in common? They're all best viewed in person. Jackson Hole Community Radio's music director, Evan Ballou, attended his first Grand Teton Music Festival concert, starting with an event geared toward demystifying the orchestral experience.
It's a picturesque July evening in Teton Village as the sun sets behind Rendezvous Mountain and the aerial tram makes its final trips of the day. Sporting colorful tie-dye, Jackson resident Justin Fuller looks like he could have been mountain biking, but he's here to see classical music. Stefan Denev leading Concierto de Aranjuez, taking listeners back to ancient Greece and Rome, featuring South Korean guitar prodigy known as Gigi.
Beyond brilliant, just every piece completely unique and amazing.
He's hooked. This is his 23rd show at Walk Festival Hall. Tonight, he's part of an unusual but growing crowd for Grand Teton Music Festival. Classical aficionado and host Carly Ann Edwards welcomes faces that may more typically be found a few doors over at the Mangy Moose Saloon.
I remember being little and seeing the bows move so synchronously and being mesmerized.
Edwards' grandmother was first chair violin with the Charlotte Classical Symphony in North Carolina, and her mother is a cellist. The 27-year-old is a classically trained opera singer. She's part of a group trying to show that classical concerts are more than highbrow ceremonies and can be enjoyed by anyone with an open mind.
realistically, like, we are the next generation of classical music supporters, and you need to gain that support somehow.
Maybe the barrier to entry is too steep. Ticket prices aren't cheap, and if they haven't grown up around it, the music might feel intellectually daunting. That's why Grand Teton Music Festival's general manager, Jeff Counts, is trying to open the gates.
The key to that is demystifying the experience, right? To make it easy not only to come, but to want to come back.
Part of that is concertgoers in their 20s and 30s find things in common with working musicians. They're here mingling. Violinist and novelist Ling Ling Huang is in her 10th summer here.
There's just more space, I feel like, to think. The opportunity to, like, go on hikes after playing with the sound of the night's concert before echoing in my mind. It's really special.
Connor Tchaikowski is another violinist in his second summer with the festival. He feels a genuine connection with the Tetons. He says his section mates do too. The orchestra recently performed a piece by Gustav Mahler, a Romantic era composer who wrote his most famous works from a cabin deep in the Italian Dolomites.
Something special about this place, I think, inspires us when we play it.
Of course, bringing in young people often just comes down to money, according to festival educator curator Megan Heinrich.
And I don't think there's a single other festival who is doing as much in the community for people of all ages for free as we are.
Young people and families also might not have the time. That's why the festival tries to meet people where they are. The festival's On the Road series takes performers to locations across Wyoming and Idaho.
They're offering free tickets to young people who maybe haven't been to an event like this before.
Advertising to people with less gray hair is also a survival tactic.
I see the kind of people who are interested in doing intriguing and risk-taking things and not just sticking with what they know. I see a patio full of people who hear, oh, a concert of orchestra music? I've never done that, but sure.
Those are terms anyone dropping Corbett's can get on board with. For KHOL, I'm Evan Ballou.
The Wyoming State Fair is coming up Tuesday through Saturday at the fairgrounds in Douglas. This year's fair celebrates 120 years of tradition and kicks off the national countdown to America's 250th birthday next year. Wyoming Public Radio's program director, Grady Kirkpatrick, spoke with Wyoming State Fair general manager, Courtney Hines, about what's on tap.
Looks to be a big year. And tell us about the Great American Fair Initiative.
My pleasure. So this year, we are part of the Great American Fair Initiative, where President Trump and his team have invited all 50 states to participate in this. So it's truly a nonpartisan celebration of Americana, agriculture, and the fair industry. And really, when we look back at the evolution of our great country, we've seen fairs be part of that thread that has just connected generation to generation, while keeping those American traditional values of agriculture, youth development, education, and even Western lifestyle, which directly relate to the state fair. Mm-hmm. So you will see some really fun stuff at this year's fair and actually at the 26th state fair as well.
Great.
So you'll see a heavy dose of patriotism. Very proud to get to be a part of this cool initiative.
I see there's a record amount of entertainment included with admission. Let's start with the rodeo action.
Absolutely. We have two nights of PRCA rodeo next Wednesday and Thursday. On Wednesday is our Tough Enough to Wear Pink night, where we'll be doing some fundraising efforts for the Wyoming Breast Cancer Initiative. And then Thursday is our Military Appreciation Stars and Spurs night. And so we encourage you, wear your pink on Wednesday. Please dress very patriotic on Thursday. And you're going to get to see some amazing, amazing stuff, whether it's our rodeo contestants, our animal athletes, and even just the production value. It's so, so cool. And it's one of those things that is a great blend of the heritage of our state and of the sport, but also with some fun, fresh perspectives as well.
You've got live music, especially on Friday night. We're familiar with Tris Muncik and the Innocents and also Mickey and the Motor Cars, right?
Yes. And what's super cool about this, on Friday night is a fundraising concert with 100% of the proceeds going to the State Fair Foundation. So those funds are used for things like special projects, scholarships, And in my opinion, there's nothing better than getting to go out, have a super fun night with your friends and your family, see some great live music, and be getting to help a great cause as well. And we also have buses that are going to be running from Casper that day. So if you want to maybe get a big group together, we'll have some really fun opportunities for you to get to connect with the State Fair in a new way and celebrate some fun live music.
I also see there's a Wyoming singer-songwriter showcase as part of the fair this year.
Yes, this is something that we started doing last year. We pride ourselves on trying to showcase as much Wyoming-based talent as possible. And the Wyoming Singer-Songwriters collaboration has been a really fun, fresh way to do that. So we actually have a stage that is fully programmed by the Wyoming Singer-Songwriters. And this year alone, they've got acts every single day of the fair, starting Tuesday, running through Friday. And we'll be posting that schedule. So if you've got some local favorites in your region that you want to come out and celebrate and support, there's a high likelihood that they're going to be in the lineup this year.
All right. And one other note on the schedule, the Demolition Derby, that's Saturday, right?
That is Saturday. That kicks off at 6 p.m. And what a way to kind of bring summer to a close when you end with a bang. And in this case, it is a literal bang. Uh-huh. We have, in my opinion, one of the best derbies in the country. All of those proceeds go to so we actually contract with the Volunteer Fire Authority here in Converse County. And so it's a fundraiser for them, but it's still just such a fun, great night and one of our busiest days of the State Fair and our largest grandstand event.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people go to the fair for the food. What's on the menu this year?
Oh, there is a little bit of everything. And so we have some great old-fashioned favorites. We have the old-fashioned ice cream. We've got our funnel cake vendor that's been here over 40 years. Jackalope Catering is coming back. They've been here, gosh, longer than I think either of us have been alive. So they've had a heck of a run here at State Fair. And then we also have some fresh favorites, like our international food booth that has been joining us for the past few years. And last season, I don't know about you, I'm a foodie. So we really want to be able to make sure that you as our fair guest can eat as much as your heart's content without going home with a tummy ache. So we started something called Fair Food Flights, which was a collaboration with two of our team members here in our organization, Devin and Coda, to work with the vendors to offer some smaller portioned items that are still based on their usually most popular. We have 9 of those participating, and you can graze your way through the fair to try some really awesome products.
Tell me about what are the Doc Dogs about?
The Doc Dogs are super fun and a great way to engage in the fair in a new way. They're actually a diving dog competition that'll be setting up here on Monday and opening on Tuesday, where you can enter your dog and show how great they are at diving into this giant pool. And then after the fair, we get to use all that water for lawn irrigation. So
wow.
It's a win-win.
Cool. I love diving dogs. And of course, Douglas is home of the jackalopes. So before or after attending the fair, folks can get their pics with the giant jackalope in town, right?
They can. And thanks to Converse County Tourism, there's also a jackalope sticker hunt that takes place all throughout the community. So if you're somebody that loves jackalopes, you can get a lot of local businesses each have a jackalope mascot that you can go and collect.
Outstanding. Well, have a great time, and thank you very much. Courtney Hines, General Manager of the Wyoming State Fair, again happening August 12th through the 16th. Enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll see you at the fair.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. A huge thanks to Ivy Engel, this episode's audio producer and digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.